This is the...
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way, Tom Hartman here with you. We're a change, by the way. We're streaming our program now through the Air America Radio studios out of New York City, and so our toll-free number has changed. It is now and will be henceforth and forevermore 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M, 1-866-440-THOM. And so just, you know, as a heads up, and I'll be repeating that as time goes on. And, of course, you can listen to our web stream. If you go to airamericaradio.com and then click on the Tom Hartman program, or, of course, go to tomhartman.com for that information. So welcome back to our program. Jan Brook is going to be with us in just a moment from the Air America, or from the from the Ayn Rand Institute. As soon as the folks at in New York tell me that he's online, we're going to discuss who owns the Internet. But until we get to that, until that happens... We heard the president's speech this morning. I don't know if you caught the whole thing or if you had an opportunity to hear it. It was a pretty pretty startling bit of bloviation. He made a number of points, some of which were actually fairly good points. But when you put them, when you consider the context in which he put them, suddenly it becomes, you know, like really strange. He starts out. He says, "Our past struggles for democracy have been worth it." Well, yeah, sure, of course they've been worth it, but that doesn't mean that what we're doing in Iraq is a struggle for democracy for the United States or anybody else for that matter. He says, well, you know, and although he does extend that logic, he goes on to say, well, you know, what we're doing over there, all this, we've made extraordinary progress in 2.5 years. And he went through the list. You know, we overturned a dictator. We had national elections. We're writing a constitution. All of that is right. And that, you know, in a vacuum, it would seem to be extraordinary progress. The problem is, you know, if that's what we're all about, if we're to say, okay, the purpose of the United States, our job, our mission in life, the reason why we're here is to run around to countries all over the world and shove democracy down their throat with the barrel of a gun, what country's next? Well, I think that, you know, in the president's list, we've got Iran and Syria probably coming up next. It's a little spooky, but... anyhow, we'll see how that shakes out. Dr. Jan Brook, Jan Brook. Is that, how do I pronounce that, Jan? It's a very nice critique of the show. I think he's with us. I'm not hearing him. You guys are going to have to punch him up there in New York because I can't do it here yet. Jan, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you now.
Hey, there you go. Tell me how to pronounce your
show for a while there.
Okay. Tell me how to pronounce your first name, Jan. I have been mispronouncing it, I think, all this time that you've been on our program.
Jan, it's fine the way you just said it.
Oh, okay, because I'd been calling you Jaron before, and
I've become deaf to the different pronunciations.
Everybody gets it wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we wanted to talk about today is the Internet. The Internet right now, the backbone is owned by the National Science Foundation, which is a government organization. It's currently run under contract by Merit, which is a joint venture between IBM and MCI. MCI, the company that Bernie Ebbers nearly took down in disgrace. Registration services are provided by AT&T under contract with the National Science Foundation. Lease lines provided by MCI, AT&T, Sprint, Wiltel. Really, you can say nobody owns it right now, although there are... You know, you have Internet, you've got ICANN, you've got the Internet Engineering Task Force assigning, you know, IP addresses and domain names. And what's got you all concerned is that there's a proposal to have the United Nations do this. Give us your take on all this. Or you go ahead and restate what I just, you know, your take on what I just said.
Yeah, well, my view is the Internet right now, the ownership of the Internet, if there is such a thing as an Internet, is diffused. It's across many companies, some government agencies. I'd like to see those go away and see it completely privatized. But it's diffused right now. Nobody, in a sense, as you said, controls the Internet. There is, I think, elements of a healthy competitive environment within the internet today. There is a proposal right now being discussed in Geneva in Europe about handing over control to the internet from these U.S. companies, from this diffused number of entities, to a regulatory agency to be run out of the United Nations. This is something being proposed by a number of major countries. I think the countries listed here include China, Brazil, South Africa, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and a number of EU countries like Norway, Switzerland, and Russia. It's opposed, obviously, by the United States and I think by Britain. But the idea here would be to take the Internet and start setting standards and regulating it from a from Geneva, from New York, from the UN headquarters, rather than leaving it up to all those myriad companies that you listed before.
But essentially, and your concern is that if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but my guess is that what you're saying is that if private for-profit corporations own, control, and run the Internet, everything will be fine, and that if government agencies, particularly an agglomerated government agency like the United Nations controls it, then our freedoms are toast.
Well, let's think about the way the Internet functions today, and the fact is that it is probably the place in which you have more freedom of speech, you have more freedom of expression than any place, even more than radio, probably. I mean, you have every different variety of expression on the web. Many of those expressions are stuff that many in our country don't even like, but it's still up there. It's still on the web. But think about what China's doing, for example. China now, with the corporation, unfortunately, and I condemn these companies for doing it, of Microsoft and Google, now has allowed its citizens to have blogs, but every time they type in democracy, the word disappears off a screen because they put in filters that filter out certain types of speech.
But they've done that without the United Nations participating. I mean, the Internet backbone is still owned by the American government's National Science Foundation.
Well, but it's not. The United States doesn't own the servers on which the Internet works in China. The United States cannot control what the Chinese do. But if you imagine what the United Nations then, if the United Nations now had control over the Internet globally, including in the United States, and countries like China and Iran and Saudi Arabia had a significant say in how that was structured. These are companies that censor expression in their countries on a massive scale. Are these the countries that we want dictating the structure?
You just laid out two logical contradictions. The first is you said, you know, okay, the NSF owns the backbone, but they don't have the servers. Private corporations are running the servers.
Or the Chinese government is owning the
servers. Right, in China, of course, the Chinese government owns everything, and neither one of us, neither you nor me, are big fans of the communist Chinese dictatorship.
Absolutely.
The big fans of the communist Chinese are found in the Bush administration right now and at Walmart. But the reality is that if the United Nations is assigning IP addresses and is responsible for maintaining the backbone, and as opposed to the National Science Foundation, that they're also not going to own the servers. The servers are still going to be owned by private corporations. They're not going to be in a position to say to exercise control over those.
Sure, but they're going to be in a position now to say who can get IP addresses and what type of IP addresses and how they link together. I mean, control over this the backbone is significant and substantial. IP addresses in the United States are handed out by a non-for-profit, private corporation.
But actually, it's the National Science Foundation that ultimately has the final say. I mean, here's the double bind that you find yourself in, Yaron, and that is that right now the U.S. government controls the Internet for all practical purposes, by your definition anyway, and you're concerned that the United Nations might control the Internet. Both of those are government agencies. You'd rather not have either one of them controlling the Internet, is that right?
Absolutely. I'd rather have either one of them controlling the Internet, but let me say that I would prefer the United States government doing anything almost in the United States than the United Nations doing it. I mean, the United Nations, this is an organization that has Cuba and Libya running the Human Rights Commission. So, this is a corrupt, a thoroughly corrupt organization.
Well, we have a lot of governments around the world looking at the Bush administration saying, you want to talk about corruption.
There's a big difference between Libya, North Korea, China, and,
I agree with
and
you.
The United States.
I agree
and,
with
and
you.
And you can't put them on the same plane yet.
No, I agree with you, but there
Nations,
is a difference between the United,
United
Nations,
Nations
and China.
They are on the same plane, because in the United Nations, they are treated equally. Indeed, China and the United States both have veto power in the Security Council in the United Nations. So it is a completely horrific organization, corrupt.
Tell me the last time that the United Nations overturned a law passed in the United States by Americans.
Say that again?
Tell me the last time that the United Nations interfered in legal processes in the United States.
Well, it doesn't.
It never has.
Let it.
It never has.
Don't let it do that. That is true.
But the World Trade Organization, a private, the World Trade Organization and NAFTA, private organizations that are pretty much run by private corporations, have interfered and actually rolled back laws that have been democratically passed by people in the United States of America.
NAFTA is not run by private corporations. That's ridiculous. It's a government.
The Chapter 11 NAFTA hearings are
held by corporate power. You know that, Yaron.
I'm against NAFTA. I believe the United States should eliminate tariffs unilaterally. I don't think we need trade organizations like NAFTA to do that.
I think we've kind of run this one out. But I appreciate you being with me.
My pleasure.
Yaron Brook from the Ayn Rand Foundation, AYNRAND.org. Good talking with you, Yaron, as always. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. 17 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We bang the drum slowly and play the fife slowly. You know the song in my heart.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes now past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our past struggles for democracy have been worth it, says George W. Bush. Well, yeah. You know, it was a good idea to fight World War II, it turns out. I'm still scratching my head over World War I, frankly, but and the Revolutionary War, I was all in favor of that one. He says, once again, we're responding to a global campaign of fear. Well, excuse me, Mr. Bush, that global campaign of fear came about because you did exactly what Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, warned you, begged you not to do. You'll recall President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt said if the United States invaded Iraq, we would create 1,000 bin Ladens. And guess what? Ever since George Bush invaded Iraq, every year worldwide terrorism has been doubling or tripling. Every year. Bush has turned a minor terrorist, Osama bin Laden, at the best estimates he had, at the highest, 20,000 followers. Perhaps as few as 5,000, maybe 20,000 people had been through his training camps, but a lot of them just went through the training camps to get the training or whatever. You know, they thought it was cool or they thought it was religious or whatever, but they weren't, you know, hardcore diehard. So somewhere between 5,000 and 20,000, depending on which intelligence service you want to use as numbers. That's how many followers this guy had. And here he is, this totally marginalized character. He was the United States and the CIA. We put him into business in Afghanistan, helped him create the Mujahideen to throw the Soviets out of Afghanistan. He was successful in doing that. After he's done, he goes home to Saudi Arabia, and now he's, you know, completely under the sway of the old Muslim Brotherhood and that ideology. Zawahiri, his mentor, the pediatrician, who was the heir of the mantle of the Muslim Brotherhood, and you know, just totally into this thing of essentially a Sunni world domination, as it were. And he goes back to Saudi Arabia and says, you know, we got to do this. We've got to take out Saddam Hussein in Iraq because he runs a secular government. He lets women drive cars and have jobs and go to school and show their elbows in public. We got to take him out. And Osama bin Laden organizes an army of his followers, a few hundred of his followers. And they head down toward the border between Saudi Arabia and Iraq to provoke a confrontation, hoping that that will lead to a war between those two countries, where Saudi Arabia will then take out Iraq and he can install a theocracy in Iraq. And the Saudis say, this guy's nuts! And they grab him and they deport him. They send him to Sudan. Say, you're out of here, buddy. And so he's like, you know, How can I get the most attention, he asks. Well, pick on the United States. That's a pretty big target. That'll get you a lot of attention. And so he goes, the USS Cole, and, you know, there's a series of attacks against the United States, and his rationale, his reason is, get U.S. soldiers out of Saudi Arabia. Ever since 1991 with the Gulf War, they've been stationed in Saudi Arabia. They're infidels. The women are driving cars and showing off their elbows, and the men are drinking alcohol. How dare they? Listening to music? Dancing? Can't have that. Not on holy ground. Get them out of there, and stop supporting the corrupt Saudi, the House of Saud, the corrupt regime, selling oil to the West for $18 a barrel. The price of oil should be between $100 and $200 a barrel, says Osama bin Laden, to reflect its true value. Those were his demands when he declared war on the United States in the 1990s. In a way, he was Osama bin Laden, and then he attacks us on 9/11. And let's assume for a moment that it really was Osama bin Laden who attacked us. It makes sense to me. I think the Bush administration probably knew something big and terrible was going to happen, and that it would help. You know, they needed a Pearl Harbor incident. I don't think that they knew exactly what it was or where it was or anything. Frankly, I'm not in the conspiracy mindset, although I have some respect for it, because those folks who are looking for conspiracies very often are the ones who uncover the truth, and very often the truth isn't the conspiracy. Sometimes it is. So, you know, I'm not saying yes or no, absolutely. But the point is, so Osama bin Laden attacks us on 9/11. Now, there was another guy who attacked the United States government because we were the great Satan. He had read a book called The Turner Diaries. It was written by a guy named Andrew McDonald. It's actually a pseudonym, but nonetheless, that's the name that is published under. And after Tim McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City, I went back and I read the Turner Diaries. I was curious, what's this thing all about that would inspire a man to kill people in his own country, his own fellow citizens? A guy who had fought in the Gulf War, who believed himself to be patriotic. And the Turner Diaries are the story of a guy rising, of a country consumed by power has been taken by Catholics, Jews, African Americans, Hispanics, and the white Protestant born again Christians have been marginalized. And this is not going to bring about the rapture. This is not going to bring about the... And so the white, born-again Protestant Christians get together, and the government's trying to take away their guns. They get together, and they blow up a federal building. And that causes the government to come down on them so hard, so very hard, that they have a rationale for the response. No,
bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. You might like to dance. 34 minutes past the hour. But you're going to have to serve somebody, Bob Dylan says. Yeah, well, you know. Are George W. Bush, his old meme has been replaced. He seems to have a new meme. You know, his old meme was pretty straightforward.
Either with us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's a pretty accurate representation, actually, of his worldview. You're either a friend of George or you're an enemy of George. And instead, I think, you know, a better question is, well, actually, before I get to that, here, George reframed these this morning in his speech. He said, we're faced with the choice of victory and glory or misery and humiliation. That's his new replacement for evil or good. He also said, if you're an ally of you're either an ally of terror if you're an ally of terror, excuse me, you're an enemy of civilization. So, you know, are you on the side of civilization or terror? Anyhow, where I was going with this thing, with McVeigh, Tim McVeigh. Tim McVeigh
believed that if he could blow up a building like in the Turner Diaries, and the Turner Diaries, what happened was the hero of the novel blows up a federal building, the federal government stomps on them like they did at Waco, like, you know, the FBI did at Waco. I mean, they come in with tanks and flamethrowers, and they're in all these Christian right-wing compounds all over the United States, and they're just crushing the insurrection, the rising up of the Christian right wing, and that causes the good Protestant gun-owning Christians across the United States to rise up in response and start a revolution. And at the end of the novel, all the Jews are dead, all the African Americans are dead, all the Hispanics are dead, all the Catholics are dead, and the only folks left standing are the good white gun-toting Christians, born-again Christians. And that's the vision that Tim McVeigh had. He thought that if he blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City, that it would bring about a renewal of America, a theocracy. He wanted to see a government of, by, and for white Protestant Christians, and was concerned that the government was, that, you know, that the country was drifting in a direction where he thought that there shouldn't be abortion because white people were disproportionately aborting their babies, and therefore you were going to have too many black and brown and yellow babies and red, just the whole thing. Well, Tim McVeigh and Osama bin Laden have a lot in common. They both thought that creating an act of violence against the government of the United States would cause the government of the United States to hyper overreact. And that overreaction was what they wanted. What they wanted wasn't the attack on the United States. It was the overreaction. They wanted us to blow back. And that blowback is what they were looking for. The hyper reaction. And Bill Clinton said, Tim, you're not going to get it. Bill, you know, after the Oklahoma City bombing, all over America, all over the world, people looked at this and said, this is horrific. Something terrible has happened. Some psychopath has killed a couple of hundred people, including children in a nursery. And Bill Clinton called for the world to be, and remember, the first few days, they actually thought it might have been Muslim extremists. He thought it was bin Laden. So they enlisted the aid of Interpol, and all over the world they're looking for who might have blown up the Oklahoma City building, the federal building. And sure enough, they found it was Tim McVeigh. And they brought him to trial, and they convicted him of a crime, and they sentenced him to death. And end of the story. And the folks in Oklahoma City, they get to say, you know, they get to have some closure. Well, when Osama bin Laden attacked us on 9/11, we had the whole world with us. There was a candlelight vigil in Tehran, Iran. There were candlelight vigils in Casablanca, in Jakarta, Indonesia, all over the world, the Muslim world as well. We had people with us saying, you know that, whoever did that, they don't represent us. That's a madman who did that, a crazy person. Let us help you find him. Even Afghanistan was willing to turn bin Laden over to anybody other than the United States, over to a world body for trial, if he would get a fair trial. And if he really committed a crime, of course you want him to have a fair trial. You want all the truth to come out. You want the guy to be exposed as a criminal. And George Bush said, nope. We don't want bin Laden. We want a war. We got to have our Pearl Harbor event. In fact, you know, Bush.
So I don't know where he is. Nor do, you know, I just don't spend that much time on him, to be honest with you.
Yeah. But why would that be? Because it wasn't about finding a psychopathic criminal for George W. Bush. It was about creating hysteria so that he could have his war presidency, so that he could have his political capital. As he told Mickey Herskowitz, his biographer, in 1999, when the guy was helping write A Charge to Keep, George Bush's biography, autobiography, supposedly. I mean, it was obviously not written by George W. Bush. Mickey wrote the first draft of it. George Bush said if he became president, if he had an opportunity to attack Iraq, he wouldn't blow it the way his father did. He would take the country, he would hold the country, and he would gain so much political capital from being a wartime president that he'd then be able to get the rest of his agenda finished. Things like dismantling Social Security and privatizing it, and privatizing education, and bringing religion into government, and government into religion, and bringing about Tim McVeigh's vision of America, in many ways.
Truly, truly spooky, truly, truly scary, truly bizarre. George W. Bush in his speech this morning conflating 9/11 and Iraq. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. He said, the calling that came to us on that day continues to this hour. Right. He said, they want to end Western influence in the Middle East because we stand for democracy. No, they want to end Western influence in the Middle East because we're taking their oil. They don't mind selling it to us, but, you know, when we take it, they don't get real happy. It's just really quite extraordinary. Okay, we got that on the table. We've got you're on Brooke with the Ayn Rand Institute, who was talking to us earlier. Roxy in Seattle on the line. Our telephone number 1-866-440-THOM. 1-866-440-THOM. Make a note of it. It's a brand new number. It will be our number in the future. And Roxy has gone. Mary in Illinois on the line. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hi.
Hey, Mary.
I'm just petrified about this plan of Bush's to start using troops in the United States. I mean, I just think it's the next thing to, him wanting to move toward a dictatorship, and I can't believe that anybody would even consider giving him the authority. And I think that the Democrats should be proactive and start now before it moves through Congress, because he's going to use this Asian bird flu as a big scare tactic, just like he's used terrorist threats, you know.
Yeah, and hurricanes.
And hurricanes, right.
And the whole thing with the hurricane was, you know, the Bush administration latching onto the meme and whipping it up in the media, and certainly the press in the United States, they were helping the wrong side, running the story of, oh, it's black folks gone wild in New Orleans. And,
right,
you know, in this, and in fact, it wasn't. It was, you know, very decent people in New Orleans helping each other out in the Civic Center and in the Superdome. And, you know, there wasn't all those rapes and murders and things that we were hearing about in the press. But, you know, black folks gone wild, that story was very helpful to the Bush administration, allowed them to say, well, you know, we need to bring in these hired mercenaries, these Blackwater contractors and other private contractors, and we need to, you know, have federal troops be able to come in there.
Right. But what the Democrats need to be is proactive, because, yeah, and this would also be a good way for them to establish some sort of plan for an Iraq withdrawal, which everybody says, oh, the Democrats don't have any plan, is to bring our National Guard home.
Yeah.
Bring the National Guard home to do its job here. We have to have them, instead of giving Bush the right to send U.S. troops into the states, which is currently against the law. They would have to change the law.
Posse comitatus.
Authority.
No, you're absolutely right, Mary, and well said. And it's just very clear. You know, Bush's vision is not that different in some bizarre ways to Tim McVeigh's vision. And maybe that's why he gave Bin Laden what he wanted. It's amazing. What Bin Laden wanted was for us to notice him and treat him like he was a big shot. And we not only did that, we virtually turned him into a god. We took him from having 20,000 at the most supporters to having maybe as many as a few hundred million supporters. It's exactly what he wanted. And then what did Iran want from us? What Iran wanted from us was access to Iraq. Iran wanted to be able to say, yeah, you know, we're going to take Iraq from you. Enough already. We're going to take this country. And, you know, it's just plain old, flat out wrong. Tom in Minneapolis on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to mention your last guest. What's his name? Your Ayn Rand guest?
You're on the air.
Okay.
You're on Brooke.
Yeah, he committed an obvious contradiction in his argument on internet control. He objected to China filtering out the word democracy on their internet, and I wanted to mention to him that last time on your show, he said he does not believe in democracy as a governance system.
Well, there's that, too.
Capitalism.
There's that. Well, that's his point, and that's where I was saying, you know, you're on you really don't want the National Science Foundation to be running this either. You just as soon have AT&T running it, and a good point, Tom, and well made. And if AT&T is running it, or AOL, or whatever, then what happens when AT&T decides that they're going to, for example, and they have the ability to do this, slow down access to any sites other than theirs, or, you know, toss pop-ups at you or whatever? It's pretty grim. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
We were born before the wind, also younger than the sun.
Then welcome back.
Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic.
Oh, you tell him Van Morrison, 9:50. Excuse me, 50 minutes past the hour. Flipping back and forth between shows here. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news, truth, and common sense in broadcasting for a change. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M. 1-866-440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. And let's see here. Lee in Charlotte, North Carolina is on the line. Hey, Lee, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Yeah. Watching or I heard some of George Bush's broadcast today.
Yeah.
I was wondering why it wasn't on prime time, and I think I know why. I think he doesn't want Americans to really hear him.
Actually, I think he did. It was the kind of speech that will actually appeal to his base. I think the reason why it wasn't on prime time, and I was hearing this buzz within the industry, right, within the news industry, as it were, was that the assumption was that he wasn't going to say anything new, and
right, but,
they were right.
But he's depending on prime time tonight because the spin doctors will be on tonight.
Oh yeah.
And they'll spin his speech.
You bet.
And Americans will hear only that.
Yeah. Yeah, you make a good point, Lee. But I think that the larger issue here, the question that I ask, and this is something that I think Americans should think about and think about really seriously. What if Tim McVeigh had had the same success with Bill Clinton that Osama bin Laden had with George Bush? Just think about this for a minute. What if Bill Clinton's response to Tim McVeigh was to go on national television and say there are radical religious ideologues among us, and there are, and there's tens of thousands of them across the United States, and they want to replace the government of the United States with a religious government, a theocratic government, and they have no place in their worldview for minorities, for other religions. They want to rule, and we therefore are going to declare war on them, and within 10 minutes the bombing is going to begin on the right wing survivalist conservative Protestant Christian compounds in Montana, Idaho, northern Texas, Utah, Colorado, Michigan, all over the country. They're actually all over the country, and we're going to begin bombing them. And then the army started actually striking with bombs from the sky these Christian enclaves around the United States where they've got all these weapons and all this survivalist stuff. Because that's what Tim McVeigh wanted Bill Clinton to do. That's what he expected Bill Clinton would do, because that's what happened in the book The Turner Diaries. Now let's take it a step beyond that. In The Turner Diaries, that happens and all the good Protestant Christians in America get out, you know, who just go to church normally but have a gun and, you know, a shotgun in the closet or a handgun next to the bed. They get so outraged that they take their guns out and they bring down the government. Okay. But let's say instead of that happening, that our government declared war against the Christians. The Christians then started fighting back. The born-again fundamentalist, gun-owning, the Tim McVeigh folks, the survivalists. I shouldn't even call them Christians. I myself am a Christian. I don't want to just kind of slander a whole religion. But in any case, these folks start fighting back and saying, enough. And they start blowing up cities around the United States. And not just one federal building gets blown up, but dozens of them. They start, you know, hitting cars with bazookas. They start shooting planes out of the sky with shoulder-fired missiles. And then a coalition of nations led by Iran and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Jordan get together, and Egypt, and they get together and they send a half a million soldiers to the United States and start bombing our major cities to say, we're going to save you from those crazy Christians. And they succeed. They overthrow our government. And then they're starting to clamp down on the survivalists, who are still fighting back, by the way, because they still want the country, because they consider themselves patriots.
According to the May
How do you think the rest of America would view that coalition of the willing that came in to take the United States? Do you think the rest of us would just say, oh, cool, glad you're here, guys? Do you think maybe a lot of average Americans would become Minutemen? Do you think that there might be a revival of nationalism and secular and regionalism and religion? I mean, just consider it for a moment. Put yourself into the shoes for just a minute of what it must be like to be living in Iraq. Stephen in Connecticut, your thoughts on all this? Hey, Stephen.
Hey.
What's up? Yeah, listen to the phone, not your radio.
Oh, well, I switched cars, so I don't have the radio anymore. But I just wanted to explain who George Bush really is. I mean, obviously.
Okay, you got 1 minute because we're just about out of time.
I'll give you one. Okay, 1 minute is good. He doesn't worship God. He worships the order of death. Obviously, since Yale, he's been in this mindset along with Kerry. So no matter what, both parties at the time.
So you think Skull and Bones is the evil force behind it all?
Yeah, well, obviously what they do at Bohemian Grove is a disgusting act. Who knows if they actually do have...
But that's not Skull and Bones at Bohemian Grove. I mean, that's been going on for a long, long time, and that's just, you know, that's basically powerful, rich white guys.
Yeah,
mostly Republican, but there's a fair amount of Democrats who hang out there, too,
and do
their bizarre little rituals.
Yeah, well, what George Bush did before 9/11 was plan a three-step thing, which is problem, reaction, solution. I believe he actually had total knowledge, in fact, totally planned out 9/11, made it happen with Dick Cheney, because obviously Halliburton, you got to make money. I believe, obviously everyone knows that the CIA was, you know, gave money to...
Well,
Osama bin Laden for...
Yeah, you know, you spot on, Stephen, that the CIA helped bin Laden. But this is where you and I part company. And I respect your point of view, but I've got to say, I think that Bush and Cheney, they knew something terrible was coming. I mean, he had 56 specific warnings. He had, you know, on April 6th, there's that Harriet Myers handing him that memo that says bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. And it worked out very well for them, but... You know, I don't think that was the be-all and end-all of it. It's Tom Hartman here with you.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, on CRN Digital. You can find our chat room at TomHartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. Just click the live chat button right up at the top, the middle of the top of the page. It'll drop you into the chat room. If you'd like to say hi, you can drop into our message blog, if you wish as well. Our telephone number, we have a new phone number. Our telephone number is 1-866-440-THOM, 440-THOM. And I think you guys are running a bumper music under there that shouldn't be there. So, anyhow, welcome back. Glad to have you with us here on the program. And time for... A conservative alert! Yes, indeed. What should we do about the poor in the United States? Well, gee, we've got a war in Iraq, and we've got, wars planned all over the world, and we've got hurricane damage and all these kind of... So, we can't raise the taxes on the millionaires and billionaires. You know, that wouldn't be a good plan, so... This from the Associated Press today. Under orders to cut agriculture spending by $3 billion. Now, let me, by the way, preface this by saying, cutting agriculture spending by $3 billion in the United States actually might be a good idea. It might be a very good idea because of the massive subsidies that we're giving to large, multinational, particularly corn growers in the United States. The price of corn and corn products has been driven down so far that we are exporting corn And by the time corn makes it from Iowa all the way to a little town in the middle of Mexico, it's still cheaper than what that Mexican peasant can grow it for, working for the equivalent of 10 cents a day. As a result, all over Mexico, all over Central America, subsistence farmers, particularly those who grow corn, are having to give up their crops because they can't sell their crops because American corn is flooding the market, and they're going into the cities. And the cities are swelling with poverty, you know, problems of poverty and crime, and people are losing their traditional homelands, their traditional farms. In addition to that, this incredible surplus of cheap corn, which started back in the early 80s, and I'd have to, maybe somebody in the chat room can let me know what year it was that Coke changed their formula, because that was right around the time that all of this was happening. And I know we got some really smart folks in the chat room. I guess is somebody would know right off the top of their head, and if not, they could find out fairly quickly. But about that time was when we started not only heavily subsidizing the production of corn, but we also started saying, we also developed the technology that gave us the ability to convert corn into high fructose corn syrup. This is a brand new chemical. It's not the old Karo syrup that, you know, those of us who are, you know, old enough can remember from our childhood. You know, this is a chemical. High fructose corn syrup is really, essentially, it's a chemical. And, okay, here, Zappa for president. Is that a guess, Zappa? I don't know. Anyhow, he says 85, 86. So what they discovered was that because we were subsidizing corn and because they had this technology to convert corn into a sweet product, into a very, very sweet product, this brand new chemical that had never before been in the American food supply started flooding the American food supply. And, you know, Coke changed their formula to go from cane sugar to corn sugar, and most other soft drinks followed suit. And now it's pretty much everywhere. Well, first of all, if you overlay the rise of corn syrup in the United States, it was in the 1980s for sure. I think it was, you know, 85, 86. It makes sense right around then. If you overlay the rise of corn syrup in the United States with the rise of obesity in the United States, the graphs are very, very similar. You can also lay the graph of the rise of type 2 diabetes in the United States with the rise of corn syrup in the United States. Now, you know, that's not to say it's definitely corn syrup, but, you know, somebody should be scratching their head and looking into this, in my opinion. But anyhow, so, and this is possible because we are taking our tax dollars and transferring billions of our tax dollars every year to big agricultural businesses and subsidizing the growth of all this corn so that the candy companies can get cheap sugar. Okay, here we go. The folks in the chat room are nailing this stuff down. ADM started making high fructose corn syrup in 1976, and Coke changed in 85, 86. So, you know, it took a few years for everybody to figure it out and for it to make its way through. But so now you have an entire food industry that's, you know, including the sugar industry, which is the candy industry, which is huge. We're talking, you know, one of the largest industries in America pushing for this, for these continued subsidies for growing corn, because that's their sweetener. And the way it was sold to the American people back in the late 70s, early 80s, my recollection is it was all through the early 80s in the Reagan administration. The way it was sold to the American people was national security. We have to underwrite the cost of making sugar here in the United States from corn, because if it's more expensive than cane sugar, people will buy cane sugar, you know, all these candy companies. And if they buy cane sugar, where they're going to get it? They're going to get it from all those nasty communists. Fidel Castro exports cane sugar. We were, you know, Reagan was fighting a war against the Contras in Nicaragua. They were exporting cane sugar. All these countries that make cane sugar, we can't have that. We've got to have corn sugar. National security. So I have to say, you know, I think it would be a good idea if we cut agricultural subsidies to these huge, there's a half a dozen of them, 5-6 multi-billion dollar multinational corporations that are the recipients of billions of our tax dollars. And that's just one example. The corn thing is just one example. So anyhow, under orders to cut agriculture spending by $3 billion. This is from the Associated Press article by Libby Quaid. Republicans in Congress propose reducing food programs for the poor. Let me say that again. They're not talking about cutting agricultural subsidies to multinational corporations. No, they propose reducing food programs for the poor by $574 million and conservation programs by $1 billion, the Associated Press has learned. The proposal by Senate Agricultural Committee Chairman Saxby Chambliss, the Republican who took Georgia, even though the exit polls, by the way, said he was losing by 10 points, somehow he won by 10 points because the elections in 2002 in Georgia were conducted entirely on electronic voting machines that produced no ballots. It was unauditable. And Max Cleland, the spectacularly popular Democratic senator from Georgia, got bumped out by Saxby Chambliss, who claimed that Cleland, who left three limbs on the battlefield in Vietnam, was unpatriotic. Saxby Chambliss, who got out of the Vietnam War with a medical deferment because he had a bum knee, he became the senator from Georgia. He's the guy who says, yeah, let's cut food programs for the poor by $574 million. Let's cut conservation programs by $1 billion in order to fund tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires. Now, to his credit, I suppose, this is not as bad a cut as what George Bush wanted. Bush asked for a 5% reduction in payments. But, you know, there's only so many poor people and conservation programs. And you go beyond that, you're going to have to start cutting the welfare to the multinationals. And they're not going to do that. It's like, whoa, you're kidding. As the Associated Press writes, leading Republicans indicated they would rather target food stamps and conservation programs than simply make the deep cuts Bush was seeking. And the administration backed off its plan in April amid fierce opposition from farmers. Cotton and rice growers would bear the brunt of payment limits. Yeah. And see, they say farmers. I mean, how many family farms are there left in the United States? I know a lot of, you know, my friend, people that I knew as I grew up in central Michigan, people that I knew who were farming, if they're still farming now, they're doing it on land that a big multinational has come in and bought them out. And now they're basically tenant farmers. They're employees of the corporation farming the land that had been in their family for years but no longer is. And that's the story all across America. You know, Willie Nelson tried to wake us up to that, try to, you know, hey, you know, let us all know what's going on. But congressional Democrats were also hostile to the cuts. Well, gee, Tim Johnson, Democrat of South Dakota. He says it's hard to see this budget balanced in the backs of poor people and struggling family farmers when agribusinesses continue to reap millions without payment caps in place. Now, this is great. The Democrats are referring to them as agribusinesses. The Republicans are calling them farmers. Another subcommittee member, Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat from North Dakota, said he and Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, are still pushing for Bush's payment limits. Byron Dorgan, one of the more toxic Democrats out there, frankly. Part of the, I believe he's a member of David Sirota's Toxic 13 or Toxic 11, the Democrats in name only. Faber called the budget cuts a body blow to global trade talks being held with the World Trade Organization. Oh, yeah, we've got to worry about the World Trade Organization, too. That group of multinational corporations are going to tell us what to do and how to do it. Incredible. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, the True People's Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this song. I could kill a couple minutes just talking to lieutenants about Saddam Hussein. I could grasp what they were saying and the dangerous game we're playing if I only had a brain.
Oh, if he only had a brain. Actually, George gave a pretty good speech this morning. It was full of nonsense and obfuscation and lies and confusion and contradictions, but it was very well said because he was talking about revenge, which is his favorite topic. Welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 22 minutes past the hour. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service is with us with a report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Well, I can talk about the president's speech, but if you've already pursued it, I'll go on to other things.
I have ranted about it at length, unless you've got some pithy insights.
My most favorite one is we're responding to a global campaign of fear with a global campaign of freedom. Global campaign of freedom. Pardon me, I don't have my eyesight. It is amazing to me. The other thing that really blew my mind was how they took credit for disrupting the black market of AQ Khan. Hello? I mean, they allowed the Pakistanis to let him off with a slap on the wrist.
Right, the ISI. The ISI that, by the way, the Pakistani intelligence service that wired $100,000 to Mohammed Atta just a few days before 9/11 that we've never really looked into.
Staggering. But the most amazing thing today is I did spend the morning from 9 a.m. till 12:30 with the two hearings going on Katrina. And I have to say this. I want to give some Republicans credit where they have their due. Many of them, really Olympia Snow, Chuck Grassley, are really on FEMA and some of these issues like you cannot believe. And
this stuff is making the Republicans look bad. I mean, they've got to.
That's true. But let me give you the Olympia Snow stat of the day, and that is that so far the Small Business Administration, which is where you have to go if you really want a loan on your home. You can't go to FEMA. You have to apply through the Small Business Administration. Most people are not aware of that. But so far they've gotten about 40,000 applications submitted. They expect about 1 million for both businesses and homes. Guess how many have been approved? Just take a guess.
30?
Out of the 40,000,
478
applications.
Boy, ay, ay, ay.
And what happens is, of course, these people don't have the documentation. Their homes have been destroyed. So now they're at least trying to get the IRS to be with them. And the new FEMA head, I have to say, he's a lot better. But one of the things he's saying is that, you know, well, we have these service centers in the Gulf, and we are available to people. Well, Shalene Espinoza, our military correspondent, is down there right this second.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not the case. They're just not available. And if they are available, not everybody has the information. And what they finally did, Susan Collins of Maine, Republican, finally got them by really dogging them. They originally said, well, you couldn't go to the disaster recovery centers to register for your FEMA number. And they had that on their website. So finally, Susan Collins got after them to say that they absolutely had to. Then there is an example that was several of the Democrats, but the Republicans really did not complain about it. An example was that there were 75 electricians at this military base that got wiped out, right?
Mm-hmm.
They could have been used to put electricity. Where did the electrical contract go? To none other than Kellogg, Brown, and Root.
And, of course, they brought in people from Texas, right, to do the work?
And there's a Mississippi school that offered to sell 200 portable classrooms for $20 million. But, a new company by the name of AKIMA, I have not had a chance to look it up. Probably it's associated with somebody we didn't even want to know. Out of state, bid twice the amount.
And got the job. And whose wife or brother-in-law or sister-in-law or, you know, campaign contributor to Tom DeLay or Roy Blunt or, I mean, that's going to be an interesting one to dig
in. And then there's an emergency assistant dispatcher that lives in Tom Coburn, the Republican's district. He complained to Tom Coburn that he was paid $5,400 for one weekend's work in L.A.,
Louisiana. New Orleans.
Right, L.A.
In NOLA,
Right, NOLA. And, I mean, he complained to his congressman saying, hey, listen, I'm happy for the $5,400, but this is outrageous.
Yeah, well, those are Halliburton pay rates. the government's just used to paying that now
and
after 4 years
there were,
of
there were maintenance workers in the Superdome who were being paid $14 an hour, but they were replaced by people who were being paid $12 an hour out of state who did not, and no health insurance benefits. And this is the kind of thing that's going on.
So they're importing cheap labor into New Orleans?
Yes. At the same time, they're knocking people off. And by the way, there is legislation for them to pay for these people that Roy Nagin had to lay off.
Yeah.
Except there is a total federal amount of only $5 million.
Incredible. Ellen Radin with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Ellen, for the report today.
You're welcome.
Amazing. Amazing. Thanks. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. I'm speechless. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman. It's
And welcome again for the Bush administration, for the Republicans. Let's close them up, roll them out, get to the polls in November. Well, a year from November. But see, if the polls a year from November are going to be clean, we need to be doing some work on that right now. And if we're going to have reasonable candidates, you need to be doing work on that right now. And if we're going to have a decent vote, we need to wake people up. That needs to be done right now. Welcome back to the program. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program today brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, or smalldog.com. You can get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, all things computer there. In just a moment, we're going to be talking with Todd Iverson of America and Solidarity. First, Linda in Sacramento. Hey, Linda, what's in your mind? Oop, we've lost Linda. Steve in Sacramento is gone, too. Let's just go right to Todd, in fact, rather than get a couple other callers here. We'll get back to you in just a minute. Hey, Todd, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
America in Solidarity, the website americasolidarity.com. And you guys are putting on a conference in Seattle this weekend. I'll be there. Rachel Maddow is going to be there. Congressman Jim McDermott is going to be there. Congressman Jay Inslee. Gold Star Families for Peace, Karen Meredith, Nadia McCaffrey, Annette Pritchard. And why did you put this thing together?
Well, as our organization is kind of a voice for working families, we were looking at, hey, this war is affecting working families more than just about anything in America. I mean, from the actual people dying in Iraq, I mean, who are, you know, coming from, you know, the middle and lower classes of America to, I mean, just the accelerated cost of the war and how it's affecting what we can't do, you know, provide health care and jobs and the infrastructure to make more jobs.
So you're reframing the war or your opposition to the war away from, you know, for example, we're in favor of peace or this is not a just war or this was the wrong war to the, you know, your issue is that this war is harming working families in America.
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, just from the fact that it's costing.
Todd, I got to ask you to speak a little louder. I can hardly hear you. I'm sorry.
Cost is, you know, $727 per person so far is how much this war has cost us. If you're a working person, how much, I mean, wouldn't you like that $700 and what you could do, provide for your kids or your family?
Yeah, and to a large extent, actually, we haven't paid the bill yet. That bill is being given to our children and grandchildren, and, you know, the wonders of compound interest, that $700 within 10 years is going to be $1,500, and, you know, within 20 years is going to be, you know, whatever it's going to be, you know, $2,000-$3,000, and it's continuing to grow, by the way.
Exactly, and how are we going to pay for health care, and how are we going to pay for Medicare? It's staggering.
But see, that is part of their strategy, Todd, and this isn't, you know, conspiracy theory stuff. I mean, Grover Norquist is pretty open about this. The strategy, in fact, they have a name for the strategy. It's called Starve the Beast. If they can bankrupt the government, then the situation will be so dire that Democrats and socialists will not dare advance those socialistic programs like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and, you know, unemployment insurance. And how dare they? You know, those kinds of programs.
Yeah, and I mean, and then when we're talking about the war, we're not talking about the fact that, hey, the corporations are stealing our pensions right now, and the Bush administration's allowing for that.
Yeah.
And they're also not allowing for, you know, we've created 170,000 new jobs in this Homeland Security Department, but they're not allowed to unionize. They don't have a voice. And what kind of jobs are we providing for working families?
Tell us about America in Solidarity, the website americasolidarity.com. It's .com, right? Not .org?
Yep. Yeah, okay. .com. We kind of set it up wrong.
Well, actually, that's fine. You know, most people kind of default to that, so that's
Yeah, I think that might have been our strategy. So
yeah.
We started up a couple years ago, We are a all-volunteer organization. We're based out of Tacoma.
Tacoma, Washington.
Yes, exactly, Tacoma, Washington. Besides doing forums and community events like this upcoming one on Sunday, we also have a pledge we offer the politicians, and mm-hmm. we've had over 50 elected officials sign our pledge to support working families. And in turn, they don't get an endorsement or they don't get money, but they get volunteers. And in 2004, we probably had about 500 volunteers get thousands of hours out knocking on doors, doing phone banks, trying to help elect the guys that speak for working families.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that a lot of people can't get money. I can't afford that $1,000 plate dinner. I don't know if you can, Tom, but most people can't. But this way they can still go out and make a difference, and maybe we'll get people elected who won't take us into war to help their corporate buddies.
Yeah, but wouldn't that be great? And in fact, that, you know, has always been the hope of most Americans. It's just very straightforward. Todd Iverson, America Solidarity, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Appreciate
and good luck with the conference. I look forward to seeing you this weekend.
Okay, great.
Much appreciated. This day in Iraq war history. Today, this from the thinkprogress.org blog. Today, President Bush ducked responsibility for the mistakes he's made in the Iraq war, saying no act of ours invited the rage of the killers. Yeah. In fact, this is fascinating. They say, they point out October 6th, today's date, and looking at things that have happened on October 6th, okay, today, October 6th, 2005, he says, no accountability. On October 6th, 2004, the Dulfer Report eliminated the primary justification for the Iraq war, said there's nothing there. There's no weapons of mass destruction. Definitely not, even after we spent $1 billion looking for them. On October 6, 2004, Paul Bremer said Bush was not prepared for post-war Iraq. Paul Bremer, the guy that he hired to go over there and turn it into a neocon paradise. And on October 6, 2004, Bush also delivered a major speech on terrorism. On October 6, 2003, White House cronyism contracts leave Iraqis without basic services. Gee, what a surprise. On October 6, 2002, Bush says we're going to liberate Iraq, not conquer them. You know, let's look at some of these. Philadelphia Inquirer headline from this day 3 years ago. October 6, 2002, headline, Bush vows to help Iraq rebuild. In his speech to, and then the article, in his speech tomorrow, the president will promise the Iraqi people liberation, not conquest, an aide said. And this is what Bush said in his speech 3 years ago today, this very day. Some worry that a change of leadership in Iraq could create instability and make the situation worse. The situation could hardly get worse. Now, this is before the situation got worse. This is before we had attacked Iraq. The situation could hardly get worse for world security and for the people of Iraq. The lives of Iraqi citizens would improve dramatically if Saddam Hussein were no longer in power. Yeah. Okay. October 6th, 2003. This would be 2 years ago. Today. New York Times. October 6th, 2003. Joe M. Albaugh, a close friend of President Bush's and the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency until last March, is here to tell you that his new company, which advises clients on how to get business in Iraq, is not trading on his White House connections. The Iraqis need assistance, Mr. Albaugh said, and he can help. Doesn't that just warm your heart? The Washington Post, on October 7th, tomorrow, 2 years ago, 2003, President Bush announced yesterday that the White House will take a stronger role in overseeing the struggle and effort to rebuild Iraq. The announcement comes amid criticism of the administration for delays in restoring power, providing security, and formulating a plan to cope with the complexities of rebuilding a country of 24 million people. Here's the bottom line. You can't govern if you don't believe in government. It's really that simple. These guys don't believe in government. They think government is a fundamentally wrong thing. They don't believe in it. You can't govern if you don't believe in government. October 6, 2004.
This is when the Dolfer report says, nothing here. This is from the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction or the immediate capability of producing them prior to the 2003 Iraq War, the chief U.S. weapons inspector for Iraq said in a report released Wednesday. Newsweek, from this day, last year, there was considerable surprise and distress inside the White House this week when Iraq's former ambassador let loose with what he intended to be off-the-record comments criticizing the administration's handling of Iraq. According to the Washington Post story Tuesday, Paul Bremer conceded in a speech at an insurance conference in West Virginia, quote, "We never had enough troops on the ground," end quote. He added, quote, "We paid a big price for not stopping it because we established an atmosphere of lawlessness," end quote. And the Boston Herald on this day in history 1 year ago said, quote, "Scrambling for a new edge since stumbling in last week's debate, President Bush abruptly reshuffled his schedule so he could deliver a major speech on terrorism today aimed at blunting Senator John Kerry's burst of post-debate momentum." Isn't it amazing? And then today, George Bush comes out and says, "No act of ours invited the rage of the killers." The killers who were not there before we showed up. Who were not killers. It was Iraq was not plagued by terrorism before the United States showed up. And it's not like we brought it with us. It's like, you know, again, I asked the question. If somebody were to invade the United States, I mean, if I'm sitting here in broadcasting to you live from the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Okay, so if Canada or Mexico were to have invaded the United States, were to invade the United States, say, "We're going to save you from that nasty George Bush. You know, he's illegitimate. His crony brother down in Florida helped him get a phony election rigged in 2000. And then people that his father had appointed to the Supreme Court made him president, stopped the count. They actually stopped the vote count. It was illegitimate. He shouldn't be your president. He wasn't the democratically elected president." And so the Mexicans invade the United States and say they're going to liberate us from George Bush. I would take up arms against them, even though it's my country. So we're surprised when Iraqis say, "Hey, wait a minute. How come when you invaded our country, you just locked down the oil supplies? Why is it that George Bush, when he first announced that he was coming into Iraq, and he said, okay, you know, this is his big speech. He says, you know, the bombing is going to start any minute now. And he turns to the camera and he says, "Now I've got something I'd like to say to the Iraqi people." And I'm expecting him to say, "You know, our kids are just like your kids, and, you know, they all have mothers and fathers, and we don't want them to die. So just lay down your arms and let's not have a fight. We're the biggest country in the world, most powerful country in the world. We're going to whomp you." That's what I expected him to say. Instead, what did he say?
"Your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells."
Do not destroy oil wells? And the people of Iraq are sitting around going, "Oh, now we know why." So if Mexico invades us and says, "Don't blow up your water supply, we want the Rio Grande intact," I think we'd be a little upset. 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, George. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Stan Stolpiak in New York, courageously running the board for us and doing a great job. It's amazing. You know, technology. I'm sitting here in a studio in Portland, Oregon. We're sending the signal to New York City by ISDN line. They're bouncing it up to a satellite up in the sky, up to the Westwood One satellite. That gets bounced over to the Jones satellite. They bounce it down to the radio stations across the country and down to Sirius. Sirius picks it up, puts it back up on their satellite, then it comes down. It never ceases to boggle my mind, the wonders of technology. And thanks to Stan for doing a great job. So, anyhow, welcome back to our program. I got to tell you about the crime of unauthorized reproduction. We'll get to that in just a minute. We have a new telephone number. By the way, starting today, henceforth, now and forevermore, world without end, amen, new telephone number, 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M, which is how I spell my name, 1-866-440-THOM.
our telephone number. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey, Logan, what's up? Logan, you are listen to the telephone, not the radio. And you are live.
Hello?
Yeah. It's not working for Logan, apparently. So I'm sorry, Logan. Let me get back to this crime of unauthorized reproduction. This is mind-boggling. I mean, this is where, you know, you think you know, right? You think you knew what was going on. You thought you understood everything. Maybe not.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Yeah. Crime of unauthorized reproduction. This is a new law. Republican lawmakers, this is from the Daily Kos, Republican lawmakers are drafting new legislation that will make marriage a requirement for motherhood in the state of Indiana, including specific criminal penalties for unmarried women who do not become pregnant, quote, by means other than sexual intercourse, end quote. In other words, if you get pregnant by in vitro fertilization, sperm donation, egg donation, anything like that, in the state of Indiana, the Republicans want, and you're not married, the Republicans want you to go to jail. Now, clearly, the targets of this are single women and gay couples, lesbian couples, who want to have a natural pregnancy, but don't, you know, in the case of single women who don't want to marry the guy that they're living with, it wouldn't cover heterosexual out of wedlock. It would only cover gay out of wedlock, because it would have to be through in vitro fertilization. Okay, so, well, or for that matter, single women who have to have in vitro fertilization to get pregnant, they go to a fertility clinic and say, you know, make me pregnant here, you know, and incredible, eh? Only women who are married will be considered for the gestational certificate that must be presented to any doctor who facilitates the pregnancy. Further, they write over the Daily Kos, the gestational certificate will only be given to married couples who successfully complete the same screening process currently required by law of adoptive parents. This is incredible. The draft of the new law reads, this is quoting from the new law, an intended parent who knowingly or willingly participates in an artificial reproduction procedure without court approval commits unauthorized reproduction, a Class B misdemeanor. You can also throw into jail doctors who commit unauthorized practice of artificial reproduction. This is amazing. Republican Senator Patricia Miller is the chairman of the House Finance Commission and is the sponsor of this bill. She believes the new law will protect children in the state of Indiana and make parenting laws more explicit. She says the laws are too vague. They're unenforceable. She says, it's not just surrogacy. The law is vague on all kinds of extraordinary types of infertility treatment. We wanted to address that as well. This is incredible. So the Republicans who have been for years saying, oh, we're all about small government. See, here's where you get it. They're saying now, if you have the wrong kind of pregnancy, you go to jail. If you're not, you know, appropriately married in the church and all that, boom, off you go. Cart them off. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. And these are the guys who have been saying, well, we're all in favor of getting government out of our lives, except when it comes to the bedroom. This is the big difference between conservative morality and historic American morality, otherwise known as liberal or progressive morality. Conservative morality is concerned with what people do in private. Who are they sleeping with? Are they doing it in the right position? What drugs are they taking at home? What are they doing in private? Traditional American morality is concerned about are there those among us who are hungry? Are there those among us who are homeless? Are there those among us who are sick? Let's take care of them. That's traditional American morality. Conservatives have no interest in that kind of morality. That's that stuff that Jesus talked about. Forget about it. That's that tikkun stuff from Judaism. Forget about that. No, they want to know who's doing what in their bedroom. That's conservative morality for you. And there's a big chasm between conservative morality and traditional American morality. It's time for us to reclaim
traditional American morality, because this country needs it. 57 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, and CRN Digital as well. Welcome back to our program. This morning, George W. Bush gave a, you know, let's pump them up speech, sagging popularity. It's the one-year anniversary of his last speech about Iraq, talking about the wonders of, you know, going into Iraq, and the two-year anniversary and the three-year anniversary of speeches on Iraq, oddly. And he conflated Iraq with 9/11 and made a whole lot of claims that, frankly, I just feel like don't hold water. I'm just very pleased and honored to have with us Joe
Hello.
Wilson, Ambassador Joe Wilson. Are you there?
Hello.
Mr. Wilson. Hello, Ambassador Wilson. Stan, you're running the board there. You got to fix it so that Joe can hear me. I don't know what's going on, but...
Hello, I can hear you now.
Oh, you can hear me now? Okay, great. Joe Wilson,
yeah.
the former ambassador, The Politics of Truth is the book he wrote, Inside the Lies That Led to War and Betrayed My Wife's CIA Identity, a diplomat's memoir, marvelous book. And Joe Wilson, Ambassador Wilson, this morning George W. Bush made some pretty strong statements. He said that we have the choice between victory and glory or misery and humiliation. This is like his new replacement for you're either evil or you're good. What's your take on this?
Well, my take on it is it's long past time for us to be talking in these sorts of terms. We ought to. It's about time that we really begin to reconsider precisely what our national security interests are and adjust our policy accordingly. We do have legitimate interests there. Now, 2 years after we've invaded, conquered, and occupied Iraq, we can't even control the security of the seven-mile road from the city to the airport. So it's really hard to see that this has been a huge success.
Yeah. Now, I have heard a story, and I'm quite sure you didn't, and you've been on the program before, I'm pretty sure you didn't tell it to me, but and I'd love to know if it's true. And it's great having you back, by the way. You and I spoke this morning on our morning program here on KPOJ,
right.
Or on KPOJ, and we have a little more elbow room here than we did then. This story is about how you were in Baghdad just before the 91 invasion, and Saddam Hussein had ordered all the Americans. He'd come on TV and said he was going to hang all the Americans. And you rounded up all the Americans, got them into the United States, the U.S. Embassy, and went out in front with a rope and put it around your neck and said, okay, Saddam, come and get me. Here I am.
Well, it wasn't quite as dramatic as that. In a background press briefing, which we did every day for members of the press, I wore a hangman's noose in lieu of a tie to the press briefing and passed around copies of a diplomatic note I just received from the government of Iraq threatening to kill anybody who refused essentially to turn over their foreigners to Saddam Hussein to be taken hostage. And the reason for that was to underscore the seriousness with which I regarded this outrageous demand. And my point, as I said to them then, to Saddam Hussein was, if you're asking me to choose between the Americans whom I'm entrusted to protect and my own life, I will bring my own rope to the hanging.
That's brilliant. Now, and you were the last senior American diplomat in Iraq before the invasion, before the war in 91, before the first
Gulf
War.
That's right. The first line of my obituary used to read, the last American diplomat to have met with Saddam Hussein before the first Gulf War. Of course, now it reads, the husband of the first American spy ever to have her identity compromised by her own government.
Yeah, by senior administration officials in her own government at that.
That's right.
So looking at the situation in Iraq, if first of all, what should we have done instead of invading Iraq? And then secondly, what should we be doing now?
Well, I think the greatest error of this administration with respect to Iraq was not allowing the intrusive inspections being carried out by the United Nations under the auspices of our sponsored resolution to work. We could have avoided this by keeping our focus on our national security interests, war with disarmament, instead of getting distracted by this idea that we had to have regime change for the purpose of bringing democracy at the point of a gun to the Middle East. That was always a very difficult proposition.
Mm-hmm.
Second, with respect to what we do now that we're in this rather dire circumstance, I think we have to, one, remember we do have strategic interests in the region, that and we do want to be able to defend them. So it does us no good whatsoever to so erode the position of the president in this matter that he has no choice but to withdraw. My own view is that withdrawal, a timetable for withdrawal, is a useless argument. I think we should begin by saying, let us strive not to put any more Americans in harm's way. Basically, get them off the streets, get them out of the business of running these offensive operations in Fallujah and Ramadi and Tel Afar. Secondly, I think we should basically stop Americans from indiscriminately killing Arabs, because all we're essentially doing is killing Sunni Arabs on behalf of the Iranian-dominated Shia government. And people need to understand that the big winner in all of this has been Iran. And thirdly, whatever happens in the vote on the Constitution, I think we need to go back to the drawing board to try and help the Iraqis come to a stable political outcome. And we cannot do that alone. So I would argue we need to redouble our efforts to encourage our European friends, and the Russians, the Turks, and Iraq's other neighbors, including Syria and Iran, to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. That will mean, of course, some type of dialogue with Iran. It doesn't have to be the exchange of ambassadors, although it's important for people to understand that we open embassies in foreign countries because it's in our interest to do so, not because we're bestowing gifts on complacent governments. But some sort of dialogue that that makes Iran part of the solution rather than part of the problem.
Now, you said that essentially Iran has already won the war in Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say that those who have benefited the most have been the Iranian mullahs, our archenemy. They have expanded their influence really exponentially. They now occupy, at least in influence, a broad swath of territory from Tehran to Beirut and from Tehran to the northern border of Kuwait. And with significant Shia populations in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, a majority in Bahrain, 30% of the population of Kuwait is Shia, they are in a position to really be able to foment instability and mischief all throughout the oil-producing Gulf region. And that's something that we need to put ourselves in a position that we can constrain their behavior.
But if we've already lost the war to them, what influence do we have? What do we do?
Well, again, regrettably, things that we should have done 10 years ago when we were in a much stronger position, we now have to do from a weaker position. But we are not without leverage. We are still a significant military, economic, and political force in the region, and we just have to begin using that force more intelligently.
Walking softly and carrying a big stick rather than shouting loud and waving around a little stick.
Offering encouragement for good behavior and political solutions. Now,
yeah.
While I think it's safe to say that an expansionist Iranian power seeks to dominate the region, that does not necessarily translate into their willing to acquiesce in broad swaths of instability on their border.
We're talking with Ambassador Joe Wilson, who is also the author of the book, The Politics of Truth, Inside the Lies That Led to War and Betrayed My Wife's CIA Identity, a diplomat's memoir. And Ambassador Wilson, how do you respond then to those folks who say, if we follow your advice and essentially retreat to the green zone or to, you know, the military bases, places where there's some safety, get our soldiers out of harm's way, if we do that, chaos is going to reign?
Well, I respond by saying in 2.5 years we've succeeded in training precisely, according to General Abu Zaid, one Iraqi battalion. But there are indeed Iraqi military men under arms. They're called the Badr Brigade, who came back from Tehran with Siri, the government that's in power now, as well as the Kurdish-trained Peshmerga, who are well-trained and willing to fight. And if I would prefer, and I think most people would prefer, that they were melded into an army that fought for a national identity known as Iraq, But that is really something for them to decide. But they are the ones who should be taking the fight to the enemy in the defense of the government that they that has been put into place. Not to force this back onto them is to ensure this, the continuation of what the generals have called, American generals have called, the culture of dependency. Our responsibility should be limited to providing logistical support, because they obviously don't have the assets, perhaps providing some intelligence platforms, although I'm not sure that we can provide good intelligence, but we might be able to put together the systems for them, and, if necessary, air support, and in extremis, only in extremis, to ensure they're not totally overrun, some ground force support. But it should be severely limited and curtailed.
Joe Wilson, thanks so much for being with us today. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
You gave them the old, stay the course, I'm your man. Why, he'll flip-flop ya. He has no strength to lead. Yes, this you feared. Why, soldiers' jobs and surplus disappeared. Gave them the old, never yet devil speak. Yes, swift boats swindled them. No one could hear the truth above the roar.
Yeah, George, you did so good.
And though your debating was a stinker, they bought it all, hook, line, and sinker. You razzle-dazzled home, and they gave you four more.
Too many OBGYNs aren't able to practice their love with women all across this country.
I hear there's rumors on the internets.
You cannot lead if you send mixed messages.
You cannot lead at all if you're George W. Bush, and that's the problem. He had to give a speech today to try and get back this whole thing. He's in charge. In the meantime, 22 indictments might be handed down in the Valerie Plame case. We were just speaking with her husband, Joe Wilson. Let's see how that thing shakes out. It's just amazing. It's the news today, just the stuff that's coming out. Harriet Myers donated $5,000 to the Bush election recount. She might have paid for the plane tickets and the accommodations for John Roberts to go down to Florida to coach Jeb Bush and how to get around the electoral and constitutional problems of throwing Florida to George Bush, even if Al Gore won. Yes, that was their plan. Tom Feeney, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Republican Speaker of the House, the guy who asked Clint Curtis, the programmer at Yang Enterprises, asked Clint Curtis to write a program that could be used with a little subterfuge, to reprogram voting machines so you could steal an election. Congressman Tom Feeney, then State Representative Tom Feeney, that the Speaker of the Florida House, said that no matter how the vote came out, even if it came for Al Gore, they controlled the House of Representatives, and the Constitution said the states shall send electors to the Electoral College. It doesn't say that there has to be a vote involved. The state can do it any way it wants, and the House of Representatives is going to decide to send Republican electors, regardless of whether Al Gore won or not. And by the way, that's what the Constitution does say. In fact, that's how the Supreme Court ruled in Bush v. Gore. They ruled, and I quote, my recollection of the phrase is the Constitution provides no specific right of Americans to vote for President of the United States. And as close as I can remember, quote, end quote. And it's true. Constitution doesn't say that you have the right to vote for the President of the United States. In fact, it says, if anything, the other, it says the Electoral College votes for the President of the United States. And it doesn't say that you have the right to vote for the electors. It's just that all the states have decided to do that over the years. But back, 200 years ago, in many cases, that wasn't how it was done. Individual states, the state legislature would send the electors, the governor would decide to send the electors. Yeah, they'd work it out. And so Tom Feeney was saying, he's going to do this. And John Roberts flew down to Florida to advise Jeb Bush on how to make his brother president, even if he didn't win the state of Florida. And Tom Feeney was going to make it happen. Tom Feeney is now a congressman from Florida. The guy who bought the vote rigging software from Clint Curtis back 5 years ago. 6 years ago. And John Roberts is now the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So, you know, you figure it out, what's going on in America. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-TOM, 1-866-440-THOM. Michelle in Long Beach, California. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I really enjoyed your interview with Mr. Wilson.
Ambassador Wilson. Yeah, he's a brilliant guy. I mean, he so understands international diplomacy, unlike anybody in the Bush administration.
Oh, exactly. And that's why I called you, because, Tom, I've been telling my husband, and after talking with this couple about 6 months ago from Iran, they were saying that really it's in the better interest for Iran if Iraq becomes, or how do you call it, theocracy through mm-hmm. the Constitution, you know,
right.
if the of this religious back kind of
if the Iraqi Constitution has the provision in it, which they have put into it, which says that there is essentially a Supreme Court, and that Supreme Court will be stacked with mullahs, and they
right.
have the right to veto any legislation, because that's how it works in Iran.
Right.
Yeah, and that's how they've been able to suppress a democracy movement in Iran, and that democracy movement was getting stronger and stronger and stronger to the point where when 9/11 happened, people were in the streets protesting in favor of America, in solidarity with America, and when George Bush gave his speech in 2002 and named Iran as part of the axis of evil, the democracy movement, the pro-democracy movement in Iran started to unravel, because all of a sudden all these people who were saying, yes, we want to be just like the United States, we want democracy, or even if the mullahs keep striking down the laws that we passed, we're going to keep coming back and coming back and coming back and making democracy happen in Iran. Those people could no longer say that, because then everybody in Iran would say, what, you're in league with the people who think we're the great Satan? We're the axis of evil?
And isn't it kind of unique? Just like you were talking about in Indiana, how and what we're seeing in our own nation, this theocracy.
Oh, yeah, it's the rise of theocracy. By the way, the folks in the chat room informed me during the break, the bill that I was telling you about in Indiana to make unauthorized reproduction a crime, the Republican bill, they've withdrawn that. I think the light of publicity caused them to realize, you know, we could talk about this stuff, we can think about this stuff, this is really how Republicans think, this is really in our plans, but we really shouldn't say it out loud.
it's kind of like Bennett.
Yeah, there you go.
You
yeah,
know,
Bennett.
I mean,
again, just saying out loud what the Republicans tragically are all about, but, oh boy, Bill Bennett. Don't get me started. That's, you know, I've done my rant on that. Michelle, thanks so much for the call. Great to hear from you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
We bang the drum slowly and play the fife slowly. You know the song in my heart.
And welcome back, my friends.
In the shining of twilight, in the
shadow. Yeah, you tell him, Bob.
You can show me a new place to start.
The DC Rumor Mill. Jason Leopold reports on RadarMagazine.com. The D.C. rumor mill is thrumming with whispers of 22 indictments are about to be handed down on the Valerie Plame case. Last time the wires buzzed this loud, saying that Tom DeLay was going to get nailed. Guess what? They were right! Could this be why Karl Rove hasn't been showing up in public with George W. recently? He's been, as they say, missing in action at more than one major presidential event. Yeah. So, Jason Leopold, he has a suggestion. He says, we have a bit of advice for Karl Rove. Go with vertical stripes. They're more slimming. Yeah. And Chip Carter is going to run for office. This is sort of the best of the rest of the news here, just a... I'm very seriously exploring it, Chip Carter said in an interview Tuesday. Not planned to run for office, he said. I have no infrastructure. This is new to me. He said he decided to run in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. This is in the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Said he was offended by the federal government's response to the disaster. Carter said, I'm more concerned than ever with the way the country is headed. So he's off to meet with Harry Reid's staff to discuss the race. Should be interesting. Should be very interesting. He's Carter described himself as a pragmatist. He said, I think the federal government does some things better than the private sector. Oh, my goodness. Somebody said that? The federal government does some things better than the private sector? I mean, this is the big cleavage. For over 200 years in the United States, we all agreed that there were things that we all owned collectively, and we collectively should exercise control over them and protection of them. For example, our police departments, our security. We collectively own our security. It's part of the commons. And we want to know that we're going to be safe and secure. And so we're not going to hire some private corporation to be our police department. I mean, why should somebody be skimming profit off the top from policing? Hey, think about it. I mean, it's the comparison is really a good one. The comparison between Medicare and private health insurance. With Medicare, about 2%. It depends on what year you're looking at and whose numbers you're using. Some estimates go as low as a little over 1%. Some are as high as 3%. But let's say between 2 and 3%, at the very most, goes to administration. So for every $100 that goes through Medicare, $2 to $3 is spent in administering the program. Sticks to the fingers of the Medicare administrators. Now, the private health insurance companies, they say, hey, we can do it cheaper. We can be more efficient. We know how to do that. We can be more efficient. We're not going to hire government employees who are members of the government employees union and who get union wages and have good pensions. No, we're not going to do that. We're going to hire people at $8-$10 an hour at the most. Maybe we'll even outsource it to India and get it done for $2 an hour. We can do it cheaper. And they're right. But for every $100 that goes through the hands of the private health insurance companies, between $15 and $30 sticks to their fingers. Now, if they can do it more efficiently than government, if they can do it for less than 2 or 3%, why does it cost 20 or 30%? Well, because we're talking about apples and oranges here. The apples being government, oranges being the private sector. In the private sector, yes, they can do it more efficiently, but see, they have other costs. They have to pay their CEOs multi-million dollar salaries. They've got to have gold-plated faucets on the bathroom and in the private jets for the CEOs to fly around the country so they don't have to mingle with the common people, even in first class on the airplanes. They have to have the world headquarters that's all fancy and spiffy. They've got to have an ad agency that deals with their logo and all their expenses. They've got to have a huge marketing budget and spend millions of dollars on advertising. They've got to have a fleet of salespeople out there knocking on your door telling you you need to buy insurance from them. They started slipping in the summer. And most important, lest we forget, since they're publicly traded for-profit companies, they have to show a profit that they can slice up and spread out and distribute to their stockholders. They have to skim 10% off the top just to pass out to their stockholders as dividends so that those people who make their living, like, you know, good capitalists, those people who make their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to come in the mail, those people will get their dividend checks. By the way, in the last tax cut, the fourth year of Bush's presidency, his third big tax cut. I'm just amazed every American doesn't know this, that this wasn't, you know, just a huge deal. I mean, it was, the business press, of course, talked about it constantly. They couldn't shut up about it. But I don't think the average American realizes that Bush's last tax cut changed the top income tax rate for people who make their living sitting on their butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to show up, changed their top income tax rate from the 30% more or less that everybody else pays down to a maximum of no more than 15%. So if you earn your income sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, maximum income tax, 15%. Social Security tax, none. Isn't that sweet? Isn't George nice?
So anyhow, Chip Carter comes out and he says, you know, there's some things government does better than private industry. Even though they're paying a decent salary to those government employees who are administering Medicare, even though they have pensions and retirement programs, even though they have health insurance, they can provide health care to millions of Americans for less money than the private for-profit corporations. Because the private for-profit corporations, by their very nature, they've got to pay dividends, they've got to, you know, they've got all these expenses. So we get back to this thing of our commons. Do you want a private for-profit corporation providing your police services? Whereas, you know, you've got a CEO who's making $1 million a year, you've got all your stockholders who are expecting their dividends every month or every quarter. Americans for 250 years, longer than that, even before we were the United States, Americans have said, no, we can do this ourselves. This is part of the commons. This isn't an opportunity for profit. How about your fire department? Do you want your fire department provided by a Fort Bravo? No, thank you. We tried that in the United States, actually. In Chicago, for example, you have several different competing fire companies. You would go to them and you'd pay them a monthly fee. They'd nail a medallion to the front of your door. Says, you know, you're with the Acme Fire Company, or you're with the Johnson Fire Company, or the Jones, whatever the fire company is. And if your house caught on fire and the wrong fire truck goes by, they look at the medallion, they say, hey, it's not our medallion, and they just keep on going. And the Great Chicago Fire sort of woke a whole lot of folks up. This isn't the best plan. Although Philadelphia had figured that out long before that, where, you know, Ben Franklin helped start one of the first fire companies. Of by and for we the people. What a novel idea. Fire company for all the people. Do you want private corporations running your army? Well, that's what Bush has given you. We're paying $150,000 a year to Halliburton employees to stand in the mess line and serve food to U.S. soldiers. Something wrong with that. It's called, you know, this is cronyism at its worst. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-TOM, 440-THOM, 1-866-440-THOM. Phil in Olympia, Washington on the line. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be with you. You know, my wife works in a nursing home, and I was quite surprised to learn that half the patients there, their care is actually funded by the Department of Social and Health Services of the state of Washington.
Through the Medicare program.
Yes, exactly. And so, in other words, if it wasn't government taking care of those elderly patients, they'd be out on the street.
They literally would be. This is why Social Security came into being, actually, in the 1930s, was because the leading cause of death among elderly people in the United States at that time was hypothermia in the winter and hunger in the summer.
Exactly. And, you know, there's lots of needs of society that the private sector will never provide because there's no profit in it, like taking care of the mentally ill. There's many
actually,
needs.
There are that included. Actually, what the thing is that they've figured out a way to make a profit out of anything. It's just that there are some things where we collectively say, you know, we just don't think that this is an area where you should be making a profit. You know, I don't want the government making my shoes. I don't want them making my TV set. I don't want them making my computer. I don't want the, you know, there's a lot of things that government should not be doing. But on the other hand, I think that we can all agree that it's not the best thing for democracy. It's not the best thing for the United States if private for-profit corporations are running our army.
I agree with you. Let me leave you with this thought, the phrase that it is the function of government to promote the general welfare. Do you know where that's from?
Yeah, it's out of the
preamble of the U.S. Constitution.
Right, exactly.
Take care.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, Phil. Good to hear from you. I mean, in fact, you know, Phil is so spot on. It's just... we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. Why? More perfect union. Establish justice. Ensure domestic tranquility. Provide for the common defense. Promote the general welfare. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It's actually seven things that are mentioned in there. And there's a history to each one. This was not just a series of, well, let's just throw in some nice words here. A very clear sense of this. You know, the first president to say that Medicare Actually, it was before Medicare was invented. Medicare was started by Lyndon Johnson. But the first president to say that we should have a national single-payer health insurance program, Harry Truman, 1947. He tried to pass it. Congress shot him down. The Republicans had gotten elected in 46. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What kind of fool do you take me for?
Yeah, George.
You stole my heart.
Welcome back, my friends. 50 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our phone number 1-866-440-THOM. San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom has a great idea. Should wireless access be for everyone or just wealthy businessmen? Stan, you can nuke that music there. The San Francisco mayor sees wireless service as a basic right. It gets back to this question of, you know, where does the commons begin and end? You know, how do we define the commons? There have been times in the past where we've said, you know, this is part of the commons, this is part of what is the commons? This is what we were talking about just a minute ago. You know, certainly our fire service is part of the commons. Our police service is part of the commons. Our public roads are part of the commons. Used to be that we thought, and most people still believe, that, for example, our airwaves, that is the electromagnetic spectrum, the frequency spectrum that radio and TV stations, for example, use, is part of the commons. And traditionally, they always paid a fee for the use of that. And there were certain, you know, things that they had to do in order to provide services to the community in exchange for use of those airwaves. The old fairness doctrine stuff. We have historically said that our physical airwaves are part of the commons. We collectively pay for our air traffic control system. It's public, not private. Our rail system was part of the commons. Although it's almost entirely been privatized now, but when it was all built, it was built with government land and government grants, and very profitable to the railroads. The poles that carry the wires, that, you know, the rights of way on which our cable systems and our telephone systems, our electric systems all travel, part of the commons. We've always considered part of this stuff in some places. In some places, the actual poles and towers are owned by the power companies. But in any case, we've always considered the rights of way to be part of the commons. You know, our city, we're going to keep the roads plowed. Our public schools, part of the commons. So Gavin Newsom says wireless internet access. You know that Wi-Fi set? You open your laptop and boom, it finds a local node and connects to it, even if it's your next door neighbors. It's a hello. And suddenly you're on the internet. Wireless internet access should be part of the commons. What a cool idea. There are cities all over America who are thinking like Gavin Newsom and saying, you know, it really, this is something, it's sort of like public libraries. The internet has become the world's biggest public library. And sort of like the public post office. The internet has become probably the world's biggest post office. I'll bet there's more messages that go through the internet every day than go through all the post offices in the world. Now, what I want to know is, how's your aneurysm? And so Gavin Newsom and some others have said, you know, this seems like a good idea. Let's consider Wi-Fi internet access part of the commons. 750,000 people, Wi-Fi access. 24 proposals have been given to the city to provide internet service. Google, Singular, Earthlink, a whole bunch of different companies bidding for this. Newsom says this is a civil rights issue. I think it's fascinating. You know, how much is it going to cost? $8 to $16 million? He says, my intent is to have the taxpayers pay little or nothing on the project. One plan, which Chris Vane, the director of telecommunications of the city of San Francisco, declined a name, has proposed an advertising-supported plan for free wireless access. That company appears to be Google. Google spokesman confirmed that its Wi-Fi access proposal could be funded through online advertising. Wouldn't that be cool? Wherever you go in San Francisco, instant free internet access. Now, some other cities are looking at plans where, you know, if you want access to it, you pay anywhere from $5 to $20 a month, but, you know, it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. That's sort of the private-public partnership. But then you get into things like cable TV. You know, it's very interesting. Our cable TV was largely deregulated back in 96. Bill Clinton, thank you very much, Telecommunications Act and then subsequent legislation. But that was the big hit. And ever since cable TV was deregulated to a large extent, the price has been going up about twice as fast as the price of inflation. And the cable TV companies have been getting very profitable. Major source of cash for those people who want to earn their living sitting around the pool on their butts waiting for the dividend checks to arrive. So there's this debate going on in the public arena, and I think it's an interesting and legitimate debate about should Internet service, specifically Wi-Fi access, or, you know, however it ends up shaking out. There are competing, now Intel has a new chip that they think is way cool that they want to have out there. Should Internet access or its more, you know, recent incarnation, should they be considered part of the commons that we all collectively pay for with our taxes and then we all collectively benefit from? And even those of us who may not need to use those specific things, we benefit from the societal benefit. In other words, I may not, you know, may never need to use the fire department. In fact, I hope I never need to use the fire department. But I benefit from it being there because my community benefits and I'm part of my community. I may never need to use the police department, but I benefit from their being there. I mean, you know, there are families who don't have kids that go to public schools, and yet they all benefit from having public schools. Why? Because we have an educated workforce. It builds the community. This is the thinking, the mindset, the frame through which we need to be viewing the whole idea of the commons. And it's so important that we take back the commons. You know, the cons have done such an incredible job over the last 20, 25 years of promoting privatization and corporate values. And at times, you know, there are a lot of things that you do want private companies doing. Like I said, I don't want the government making my shoes. But it's also important that we understand that there's an important role for government. And so I tip my hat to Chip Carter for coming right out and saying it. And thinking that he should run for office because he's so disappointed by the government's response to Hurricane Katrina. That, of course, because we have an administration that doesn't believe in government. So how can they govern? What do you expect? Thanks a lot for being with us today. Thanks again to Stan in New York for running the board. And to David Poole here in Portland for producing the program. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.